George Saunders is the author of 9 books, mostly of short satirical stories and essays. He's won many awards for his writing, and Time magazine has even named him as one of the world's most 100 most influential people. Goodness. Lincoln in the Bardo is George Saunders' long-awaited first novel. It's a hugely original and moving book. Lincoln in the Bardo is set, not surprisingly, in 1862, in the darkest period of the US Civil War. In the course of that year, President Abraham Lincoln and his wife Mary lost their dearly loved 11-year-old son, Willie, to a sudden illness. For Lincoln, the burden of this terrible grief was laid on top of the strain of running a war. Newspaper reports from the time recorded that the president came to the crypt several times to visit Willie, to sit with him alone and to hold his body. And this is the basis of Lincoln in the Bardo. George Saunders is here as a guest of the Sydney Writers' Festival. Hello, George. Welcome.
Hello, Richard. Thanks for having me.
This starts with that crypt I mentioned in Washington, D.C. Tell me about the first time you went there.
Well, we drove by and I heard the story. My wife's cousin told me this and it got into my head and kind of percolated. And so I went back many years later, actually, when I was thinking about writing this book. And at first we couldn't find the crypt. It's really in a distant part. And my wife's cousin kind of did a little extra effort, and we found it. And it's actually the last crypt in the graveyard from two directions. It's in a corner. And it's very humble, very small stone structure that was actually lent to the Lincoln family. That just Willie died in 1862, and a friend said, you can basically, you know, leave him here until you go back to Illinois. So it's very... you know, a little stone box on a hillside.
Can you go inside? You
can't, but it has a grating, so you can look in. And there are about 12 sort of slots where the Carroll family's beloveds would go in there into the wall, basically. And Willie had a certain spot there for 3 years.
What do people say about Willie, the kind of boy he was?
Well, somebody said he's the kind of child that you imagine having before you have children, you know? So I think he was a sweetheart, really smart, also not perfect. He was kind of a hellraiser and a little bit of a wild kid, a little bit undisciplined. But I think he was probably of the Lincoln kids, the one that Lincoln identified with most and kind of put the most attention into and had the most potential. So that made it that much more bitter.
Yeah, they had 3 sons, didn't they? They had Robert was the eldest,
Robert,
I think,
yeah.
Who was a young adult by the start of the Civil War. And he didn't get on too well with his dad, did he?
No, there was something funny between them. Even years later, when Robert would talk about his father, there was a slight begrudging quality to it.
Yeah, Robert seemed to like a sense of humor or something.
I think
maybe that's what it was. Lincoln, they just couldn't quite intersect with each other's personalities. And then there were the two little boys, Willie and his younger brother, Tad. How different were those two boys?
Well, Tad seemed to have some kind of developmental issue, so he spoke very late, and so I think he was sort of the apparently very lovable kid, but Willie was the one that they had the most hopes for. You know?
Was Lincoln a doting father?
He was. He was kind of, by certain accounts, a neglectful father, the kind of father who, in order to not do any harm, doesn't ever do any disciplining. So there's stories about the Lincoln boys coming to the law firm in Springfield and running around on the desk and knocking over inkwells, and Lincoln just sort of smiling.
Even in the White House?
I mean, they did all kinds of things. They had a mock burial ceremony for an animal, and they would steal... They would kind of run through Lincoln's meetings, and he, you know... Apparently, he really loved them, and it actually didn't bother him that they were wild men.
You get a sense that this was a bit of escapism for Lincoln, to be a boy, I suppose, and shrug off adult cares.
I think so. I mean, there's some mystery about his own childhood. You know, we don't really know much about it, but it seemed like he didn't attend his own father's funeral, kind of pointedly, and so there's kind of a shroud over the whole thing. But I think I can identify with Lincoln because as a father, I have 2 daughters, and I always felt it was easy to just love them and let them go their own way, rather than actually try to, you know, get in there and possibly make a mistake.
Not so much spare the rod and spoil the child, just spare the rod and have a lot of fun.
That's right. Yeah. Spare the rod and let the kid figure it out for
and herself. Then clean up the mess afterwards.
That's
or pay someone to do it.
Yeah. But that was part of the sadness of his death was that, you know, at the time they didn't really know why he'd gotten sick. So there was some thought that, you know, maybe if he'd been better managed, he wouldn't have been out in the cold. Or there was also apparently a soldier's hospital near the White House, and the boys were allowed to run wild and go over there. And so there were sick soldiers. And so there's some thought that the typhoid might have actually come from one of those excursions and so on. So as a parent, I'm sure you would think maybe I should have prevented this or could have.
So he fell sick with typhoid, and his little brother did too.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And the night they fell sick, there was a function, a state function being held in the White House. What do you know of that night and how it unfolded?
Well, they'd been sick a little bit. They were confined to bed, and the Lincolns had planned this big party. And so there was some talk of canceling it. And one of the doctors said, nah, I think it'll be okay. They'll be fine. So they had the party, and they had a Marine band and loud and hundreds of people.
And was this controversial, having a big party during a war?
Yes. Well, not widely, but there were people who were grousing about it because why would we have this big party when people are dying? But then that was, as fate would have it, that was the night that Willie took a serious turn for the worse. So both parents were, I think, guilt-stricken about that. If we hadn't have had that party, it might have been, better and so on.
So after the party was concluded, during the party, was the president and Mrs. Lincoln, were they going upstairs to check on?
Yeah, in fact, I think even McClellan said in the sort of the entry line, you could see that Lincoln was preoccupied and very sad, and they would just take turns running up and down the stairs to check on the boys. Yeah.
So how long did Willie linger after that?
I think it was maybe a week or two. Not very long. Yeah.
And then he died.
Yeah. Yeah.
How heavily did that fall upon both the Lincolns?
Well, the last conversation they ever had, the day of Lincoln's assassination, was about sort of some version of, we haven't been right since Willie died. Let's try to get ourselves back on track as a married couple. So I think between that, and of course, then Tad died a few years after that, and then Lincoln died, or maybe vice versa. So I think Mary never recovered from it, and yeah.
Mary is a really interesting character all in her own right, Mrs. Lincoln. She was very intelligent, highly strung. What do you make of the relationship between Lincoln and Mary?
You know, the fun thing about writing this book is that, unlike our time, people were so private. There's no place where he's ever talked about his marriage. But I think it was a very deep and loving marriage. She was apparently a great beauty as a young woman. She clearly always had his best interests in mind. And he behaved, to me, by inference, he behaves like a man who very much loves his wife and values the way that she's formed him.
Didn't he say something along the lines, I'm just vaguely remembering this, something like, never argue with your wife. Didn't he even say something like, never argue certainly about the small things,
yeah.
Never, just let that stuff go.
Well, there's a famous case where they were on an outing to the battlefield, and a woman kind of flirted with Lincoln they rode out alone together, and Mary flipped out, and she was enraged for 2 or 3 days. And what you don't see Lincoln doing ever is turning to her and saying, back it down. He actually, he went out and apologized, and he kind of tried to intercede on her behalf, but he never tried to rein her in. So I posit something very deep and loving in that relationship. And certainly, she was a great advisor to him, and
had his best interest at heart most of the time. In any case, he after Willie died, Mary took to her bed, didn't she?
She did.
For quite a while.
Yeah.
Couldn't get out of it. But Lincoln never had that option, of course.
No, he was at work within a couple days.
The newspaper records, as I said, record that he did go to the crypt once, twice, several times. What do we know about this? I mean,
funny. At one point early in this project, I went and just confirmed that, and then I never looked at it again. But I think it's in a book by Coonhart, mentioned that Lincoln entered the crypt on several occasions, and to me that was the interesting thing about the book. I could understand a father going in once, especially in those times when death was not what it is now. There was much more interaction with bodies and so on.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's the several times that was fascinating to me. You go once, all right, you did it. To go back a second time is really interesting. So for me, with the novel, I think there are several operative questions that have to power you through it. And for me, the question was why the second time, and then why do you keep going, and then why do you stop going? What's the thing that finally allows you to say enough is enough? And
do we know what he did in there when he was alive?
We don't. And in fact, I spent 4 years with this material, and only at the end I thought, how would we know? Who is it that reported that to the newspapers that he went in there? We don't know that. So that was, in some ways, the great appeal of the book was it's this beautiful, emblematic, crazy thing that he did. And that's all we know is the fact of him having done it, maybe. All the other stuff is to be discovered by the writer.
I find this so incredibly tragic and poignant, this moment. This man capable of so much love, operating under this terrible, awful burden of running a civil war, which is in many ways crueler than a war between nations, isn't it?
It's, yes.
It sort of almost paralyzes me to even think about how awful that is. And how do you get past that to write about these things, George, that moment of deep tragedy and almost unbearable sadness and strain?
I think that was interesting to me, the idea that, okay, so most of the times in our lives, we function with a positive view of ourselves and a positive view of what's to come. So, you know, some way of constructing a world around ourselves that makes it possible to go out into the world in relatively high spirits. With Lincoln, you see a guy who's, you know, in grief, extreme grief, is losing a war because of his own bumbling at that point. That loss involves 10 or 20,000 deaths on certain days. The whole country is turned against him. He's a figure of mockery. So there's nothing left for him to lose. I can't imagine any way that he could wake up in the morning and say, this is going to be a great day. So whatever he's running on is something wonderful, but also something that most of us never have to do that, you know? So that was interesting to just ask a question. You're at the lowest point of one of the most difficult lives in history. What's the fuel at that point, you know?
You know, there's another president, Calvin Coolidge, who lost a son while he was in office. And in his first year in office, he was hailed as a remarkably effective president. Mm-hmm. But after the death of a son, he went to pieces and could barely get out of bed for the rest of his presidency. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that didn't happen to Lincoln? Do we get to the realms of mystery here? I mean, can you fathom that kind of the ballast or the kind of strange realms of endurance and resilience that existed in that man?
Well, this is where it is supposition, but to me, it seemed that it couldn't be. It had to be related that he lost a young son at a time when a lot of people were losing young sons, possibly because of him. That seems to me a possible explanation. In other words, he has this tremendous loss. He looks up. He's the maestro of loss now. Can you stay indifferent in that mode? No. Suddenly, everything is super. Every death is supercharged because of your loss. You know, it also might just be, I mean, I think there's an argument he made that he just lost himself in work, you know, as I think many of us would do in that situation. What can possibly keep me alive? My habit of ambition, my habit of work, my habit of exerting energy.
Service, perhaps. Maybe the idea of service to other people.
I think so, yeah. But also, you know, and we see this towards the end of the war, Lincoln was not a particularly religious guy. In fact, I think he was a pretty energetic agnostic or maybe even atheist. But you can see, you know, this almost Shakespearean level of misfortune that he's experiencing, causing him to kind of say, all right, wait a minute. Now, let's not call it God, but something is doing all this. Even if you just say it's the universe is acting out. Can I possibly arrange my mind and actions so that this thing isn't continually trampling me, you know? Or if later he says something like, you know, providence seems to have an intention here. Providence could end the war if it wanted to, but it doesn't seem to want to. So I think he positioned himself as a kind of almost like a handmaid to God, you know, or an assistant to God to say, what is it that you're trying to tell me here? So that you could argue that's the most profound spiritual position you could be in, to say, I have no idea what God is. I have no sense of what God is, but God is a force for something, and I want to be on the right side of that force, maybe.
Just on that idea that he became to this idea that as the war progressed, that he was some sort of the instrument of an unknowable God or the unknowable will of God. I went to Washington for the first time in 2011, and I've always been a Lincoln fan, which is why I'm so really pleased to be talking to you about him, George. I went to the Lincoln Memorial. You know, there he is sitting on that incredible Republican throne of his, the marble statue of him. And next to him, engraved in stone, are these words from the second inaugural address of Lincoln's. And this is what he said, which is very much to what you're talking about now. He said this in his second inaugural address. Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet, if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled up by the bondsman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, as was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. That's an extraordinary thing to say.
What a writer.
I know. Yeah, well, I think he's one of the great American writers of the 19th
century.
He's
the great American writer.
Isn't
he?
He's like this Mark Twain, him and Melville Babson, and that's it, isn't it, really? That's an incredible thing to say. He's saying there that it seems to him that the war is the punishment on America for slavery, and that the lash of the slaver's whip against the back of the slave is to be repaid by blood in this war.
I almost hear it as a karma corrective. You know, after all this terrible injustice, it's that knot has got to be untied somehow. And the war, as he understood it, is some really complicated way of untying the knot.
I suppose looking at the same way, you could see the, I don't know if I'll go down this path, but the Second World War is untangling the mess of the First World War in that sense. You know, early on in the war, his general, McClellan, who was the most popular man in the North. And McClellan was an idiot. We know this now. He was a prevaricating idiot that talked like he was a hero. Lincoln was trying to goad him to act, to do something, to win the war, and McClellan just wouldn't. That seems like an anxiety dream to me, isn't it? Like, you know, you have this anxiety when you're present during a war and you can't get your general to do a damn thing.
Well, at that time, there was also a popular movement to make McClellan dictator, and he knew about it, and he would write these kind of slightly braggy letters to his wife. Well, everyone wants me to be a dictator. I don't know, but I probably won't do it, you know. And meanwhile, Lincoln's trying to get this guy to
do something. Yeah. Is the story about Lincoln goes to see him at his home. He comes home from the battlefield, goes, oh, I'm too tired to see the president. President I'm gone to bed.
Yeah.
Wow.
And Lincoln ends up waiting for an hour or something before they even tell him that. Yeah.
And he doesn't make a fuss.
No.
He just goes home.
And Lincoln was not a person who was low on courage. But he was very high on discernment. So in a situation like that, you can see him always figuring out what's the most positive outcome, how do I get there? And his own ego doesn't seem to have a stake in it.
Let's go back to this moment in the crypt with Lincoln with his dead son. He holds his dead son in this, which is incredibly poignant. His son is there in the crypt, as you have him in the novel Lincoln in the Bardo. He exists, along with the spirits of several other people, trapped in this space which you call the Bardo. That's a kind of purgatory, isn't it? Tell me about the Bardo for those who wouldn't be familiar with it.
Well, it's the Bardo is a Tibetan word for just transition, any transitional space, and the way it's popularly used is to describe that space between the moment of your death and whatever comes next, which in the Tibetan tradition would be reincarnation. So here I started out thinking I'd do a sort of a correct version of the Bardo as represented in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And about 2 weeks in, you're like, no, this is a novel. We're going to make this afterlife crazy and wild. But I kept the word just to remind myself that it wasn't the Catholic purgatory of my youth. It was a more kind of transactional, so anything can happen in that space. So it's kind of purgatory, but the you know, in those Tibetan tradition, your afterlife is made by this one. So the state of mind that you're in now just kind of get supersized when you're dead. So whatever neuroses and habits, negative or positive habits you have, they get kind of exaggerated. So the trap is made that way, as is heaven. You know, heaven and hell are both made by your state of mind.
All the ghosts that are in there in your novel, in the Bardo, in the script, they're stuck for one reason or another. And Willie's there too. How is Willie stuck? What keeps him stuck?
I always thought it was just two things, his love for his family and the sense that he would have had as a golden boy that great things were ahead, you know. And I can remember as a little kid myself, a bit of a golden boy, thinking, oh, this is going to be one great life, you know. So I think if I had kicked off at 11 years old, I would have been, wait a minute, I have this ticket I have to, you know, to cash in.
And that's it. He feels that. How about his father's grief? Because in a sense, you've got Lincoln who's there in that crypt. He's kind of in the Bardo as well. He's kind of stuck as well.
Right.
Is that what you think you were thinking?
Yeah. The book is Lincoln and the Bardo, and I meant that you could read it either way. It could be Abe or Willie. Yeah.
Were you daunted writing about this figure, Lincoln?
Yeah. That's why I put it off for so long. I thought, that's like writing the Jesus novel. You know, I can do it. But then, you know, for a writer, at one point, the thing that daunts you is actually your best friend, because it gives you a whole list of ways not to do it. You know, why don't you want to write about Lincoln? Everything's been said. Okay, then therefore you have to say something that hasn't been said. What voice do I use? Do I want to do a first-person Lincoln book? I don't think so. So suddenly you've got a challenge to work around. So I think that in some ways the best book is the one that you really don't want to write, and you could list all the reasons why it would be stupid. You know, I had a thing one time with a Hollywood producer, and I had written he wanted me to write a kind of a domestic scene, and I thought, I don't do that. And I wrote it, and I just sent it off, and I said, you know, if we do this in the wrong, if we do it in a sucky way, it could really be terrible. And he wrote back very tersely, how about we don't do it in a sucky way? So I think that's the, you know, when you find a book that terrifies you. So that was my mantra for this book, was don't do it in a sucky way.
There you go. That ought to be printed out in large letters and put in any creative enterprise. Don't do it in a sucky way. That's very, very wise indeed. I wonder if you're kind of, your background is that of the word as a satirist, writing satirical stuff helped you in this case. You know, there's in your mind is Lincoln at the Lincoln Memorial, 100 foot high and a chair saying, how dare you, sir?
Right.
And does that kind of bring out something impish in you, that the idea of, well, why not? You know?
Yes, yeah, exactly. Because he was a funny guy and he told a lot of off-color jokes. But, you know, to me, how do I say it? To be known as a funny satirical writer and then go into this material is actually great. Because what it means is something like this. When you tell the story about this crypt and the death and the grief, it sounds very somber. And of course it was. But we all know that life itself is never purely tragic. You know, you go to a funeral, somebody will pass wind. That's funny, you know. Or in the midst of a very funny, drunken conversation, someone will say the truest thing they've ever said. Oh, yeah. So the whole division of comic and tragic is partly a function of our limitations, our limited minds. But in real life, those two things are right on top of each other. So in a way, I think I set the novel up in advance to not allow me to get too somber, but also not to get too silly. There, it's a kind of a table that's set that I could sit down and then try to discover the mix of those two qualities.
Is there something nonetheless really attractive about writing of a period that kind of exists in many ways, in a kind of utter moral clarity, like the U.S. Civil War? Lincoln himself once said, I'm quoting him here, he said, if slavery is not wrong, then nothing is wrong.
Right.
You know, that simple moral clarity, that was right. one of the most brilliant aspects of Lincoln, is he's kind of a moral genius in a way, I think, like that. Is that attractive, writing in that kind of highly highly crystalline, clear moral environment?
What was fun was to go in there and then deconstruct it, because in fact it was anything but. You know, it was very much like the current time. The Confederate arguments for slavery were so articulate and so well reasoned. And I think for a person at that time, they were 60% sane. People had been habituated to this terrible institution. So reading the correspondences back and forth and the newspaper editorials, it's eerily like today. And it made me realize that America has never been stable. Maybe any country, but particularly America. It's always been a quite insane place, and it was quite insane in his time. The one thing, if you read the great history books about it, his voice comes through crystal clear, simple, syllogistic, logical. And meanwhile, everybody else is like, I imagine myself to be partisan, slightly tilting the argument, so I'll always win. But Lincoln was kind of a sage, I think. He was ahead of things.
Yeah. His background was dirt poor, like literally dirt poor. He, you know, they famously grew up in a log cabin, but that was a log cabin, wasn't it, with a dirt floor and everything else?
And it was probably not as nice a log cabin as we're imagining, you know. You know, I think that if you could imagine the poverty of that time, and the moral poverty, I mean, it would have been a pretty amazing thing. So for him to make the progress that he did, especially in that last 5 years, that's something that I still regard with awe, that he went from being a very poor, local, almost scheming politician who was constantly failing, kind of blundered into the White House through a kind of a bit of funny business, really. And then in those 5 years, I think he led the way, and we still haven't caught up with him, actually, in terms of his understanding of equality and freedom being the same feature, actually, and this radical idea that when you say everyone's created equal, that's not a joke. You mean everybody. And you don't mean we, the privileged white,
whatever, me and my friends, yes.
Yeah, are going to deign to give you some equality. We mean you were born with it. And even before you were born, we were all equal. That's a radical notion that he was just getting his head around in the last 6 or 7 months. And of course, as a country, we're still kind of stumbling along behind him.
He said something I've never heard a politician really ever say before. He'd confessed to having a little motor of his ambition. He admitted he was ambitious.
Sure.
Sometimes I get the sense with reading about him that his ambition came from a stark terror of ending up like his dad. Do you get that sense too?
Yes, yeah. He said another thing. He said something about, I think he was quite young, but he said something like, I just want to leave a mark. You know, I want to get through this life. I don't want to get through this life and be totally forgotten. And that rang a bell with me. You know, the idea the idea of trying to do something wonderful and trying to be known are not necessarily separate. And to have ambition isn't necessarily unholy. I mean, I think one uses your ambition in order to try to achieve or get in the realm of greatness, at which time maybe then the ambition falls away. And I think by the end of his life, you can see that I don't think he was thinking about how he'd be remembered, actually. He was in touch with so many people's pain. By the end, it seemed like he was in some high space, you know, spiritual space.
One of the things I can always tell about, you can tell about Lincoln is that he was so poor, he wasn't proud of it. He never sort of went and said, you know, I know more about life because I grew up in a log cabin. He went, I'm so glad to get out of that log cabin in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
Listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler.
There's a lovely part in your book where you've just got a whole lot of different reports from a whole lot of different people on how ugly Abraham Lincoln was. People would say, oh, God, he's the ugliest man I've ever seen in my life. And people have had different variations of that all the time. Was he ever attractive, though, to other people?
Well, yeah, I've read an account that he was very appealing to women, actually, in person. He
really?
Was very tall and very powerful and also very attentive. But also, this is really wonderful, he knew that. And because of his marriage, he would do a lot of sort of deflective work. He if a woman was sort of not coming on to him, but, you know, being a little bit...
forward, perhaps.
Forward, yeah. Yes. He would just subtly move away from her and, yeah.
deflect the attention.
Because I think his... I also think I read that he has had quite a strong sexual urge, but recognized that that was, you know, that wasn't proper, so no. he managed it, you know.
The more seriously, he was often disdained by snobs who called him, you know, the original gorilla or a barbarian. We have a Bruce in the White House, and they couldn't have been more wrong. Why was it so hard for these people to see him clearly, do you think?
Well, it was class. You know, he came from I think it would have been unimaginable even 20 or 30 years before that someone from his class could have any power, you know. And I think also his clothes didn't fit right. His legs were so long. He sat in this kind of funny way. And he had this great, you know, he told a lot of dirty stories and dirty jokes. But actually now you read them, they're kind of like these Zen koans. He would sometimes tell them to defuse the situation. Somebody would come in with an inappropriate request. He'd tell a filthy joke that would embarrass the person and send them out of the office, you know.
He once told a great story about when he was trying to make a point about a bossy general, that about a horse that once got so sort of reared up so much, it got its own hoof caught in its own stirrup. And the writer said, if you're going to get on, I'm going to get off.
That's right. Yeah.
That's a very nice way of making a point about those, exactly. About those things. Yeah. What would you describe as his style of leadership? How far ahead he could get of the people he was leading?
Well, he was a real politician, in to use that term in a nice way. He would, for example, in slavery, it seems that he was against slavery dispositionally for a long time, but he was always watching the populace to see what they would stomach. So part of his genius is that he knew that if he introduced an idea at this time, it would tank and he would lose. So then he would just hold back. He also had a really wonderful way of rhetorically preparing the country for what he was going to do. So he'd say, for example, now I'm not proposing X because that would be completely silly, but if one was going to propose X, here might be the reasons. And then 6 months later, he will propose X. So he had a really skillful way of dealing with people and kind of preparing and managing expectations. And then at the critical moment, and, you know, for example, with the Emancipation Proclamation, he was right on the edge. He didn't actually know whether that would provoke a general rebellion or not. So he just waited until, you know, the exact moment and then...
Yeah, he had that great sense of timing, that fantastic politician sense.
And he knew the people. I mean, he had been in the world so widely that he really understood the way that people came to an idea and embraced it and so on.
In Lincoln in the Bardo, there's obviously this fantastic element there of these spirits lingering around Willie's crypt and Willie there and Lincoln in that crypt with them. You often incorporate in your writing these fantastic elements. Is this a way of, I don't know, creeping up sideways on an emotional truth?
It is. And actually, to be honest, my whole writing method is it should be entertaining. It should, there should be energy in the work. So at a certain point, if one approach is insufficiently energetic, then you have to shake it up. We have a painting in our house by this young Chicago artist, and he came to hang it for us. And it's kind of a bacchanal, very kind of wild. And one of the features that catches your eye is there's these flying pork chops. These pork chops are flying across the screen. So I asked him, you know, so tell me, what was the idea behind the pork chops? And he said, well, I'd finished the painting and there wasn't enough energy in it. You know, so there's something very deep in that. We talk about writing as if there was some big intention and then we, you know, execute it. But my experience is you're actually 99% of the time you're trying to keep the experience energetic for the reader by any means necessary. For me, I have kind of a sentimental, almost pedantic streak. I like black and white morality. I like to demonstrate a moral. That can be very dull. So I'm always looking for a way to shake it up a little bit. And the strange mystery is when you shake it up by introducing a ghost or a sci-fi element, it always hastens the truth-telling. You know, you can be telling a very nice story that's a little bit flat. When you liven it up, suddenly you're telling the truth more energetically.
I'm going to quote from one of the preface you wrote to your book of short stories called Civil War Land in Bad Decline. You're talking about yourself here. I'm going to quote you here. He sent the trained dog that is his talent off in search of a fat, glorious pheasant, and it brought back the lower half of a Barbie doll.
Yeah, that's my life. I was from a working class part of Chicago and didn't know any writers or artists. And so my whole entree was really comedy, Monty Python, Richard Pryor, and so on. So when I finally was in a position to be a writer, I couldn't quite... I wanted to be classical. You know, I wanted to kind of be someone who was writing above my own station. And that didn't work. So the big turning point for me was when I realized that all the things I actually lived by... humor, scatology sometimes, a fast pace, frank communication. Those were the only gifts I had, you know. So those got into the first book and suddenly went, oh, yeah, maybe literature is actually just a person truly being themselves and using that process to even find out a little more, with a little more acuity who they are.
Huh. So it's like be your approaching the writing as your authentic self, rather than the person you think you ought to be.
Exactly, and that means how do I communicate with an imaginary reader, which should have something to do with the way you would communicate with an actual person. You know, so for me, the whole process of writing is sort of writing something, imagining where I've just put you as a reader, and then sort of looking closely at you and saying, "How are we doing?" You know, if you think I'm being too serious, I got a joke for you, you know. If you think I'm being too silly, I'm going to steer it to some higher, more serious ground. So that is, for me, was a big moment to realize that it's not about performing. It's not about, certainly not about some kind of intellectual aspiration, first and foremost. It's about, can I keep the reader on the wire, you know? And if you can't, then all of this stuff about theme and morality and content goes away because the person has shut your book. So it's sort of an intimate communication between two people. And the beauty of that is if I keep imagining you as slightly smarter than I am, then we have a nice relationship. And that plays out on the smallest level, line to line. If I correct a sentence by 10%, the theory goes, you appreciate that. And you read that as increased respect for you, which then makes us better friends. And we're off to the races.
During the 2016 election in the United States, you wrote a long piece for The New Yorker about the Trump campaign, which was one of the best bits of journalism that was written about that campaign, where you followed the Trump campaign and attended many of the rallies. What kind of people were you expecting to find at those rallies, and were they the people you found?
Well, what I hoped was I would find four or five incredibly big-mouthed bigots that I could just quote and send it in and get the check. And what I found was, of course, a wide range of people. And the piece was very difficult for me because the people I found were people that I knew, with people that I had lived with, and people, many of my extended family are Trump supporters. So I think I wanted to find extremists, and I found people that were alarmingly normal.
Which, alarmingly normal. That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, we had a great time talking. We had a lot of things in common, except when we got on the politics, then we diverged. But that should have been a bit of a wake up call, because it wasn't. At that time, a lot of the films we were seeing on TV were of somebody punching somebody or somebody in a KKK robe and so on, and that wasn't what I found at all.
Journalist Paul McGough once said to me, the thing about, he reports from Washington, he says, the thing about the United States, is he's come to realize, is that nothing ever gets resolved in America.
Right.
Nothing. No political question is ever resolved and put behind the country. And if you look at a map of the intensity of Trump's voting support, it maps pretty well onto the old Confederate states. Is this something that comes to mind? Do you see kind of resonances there with the Civil War of 150 years ago and the kind of partisan, intense, rancorous partisan divisions that exist in America
today? Yeah, I think
today?
We never figured out race, actually. And this is the tragedy of Lincoln's death. I think, now, of course, he's a saint, but I feel like if he had lived, he would have guided the country through the Reconstruction in a better way. And he would have forced it to a head, to say, do we believe what we say in the Constitution or don't we? If we do, then we have to live into it. And I think he would have made a way for Southerners to embrace that idea and still not feel, disrespected by it. Now, I'm probably dreaming of Lincoln, but what happened was, we had this Reconstruction that basically just reinstated slavery by a different name. We never repaid the trillions of dollars of work that was done by those men and women. And we never really apologized. It was something, that was a terrible mistake, our bad, sorry, and the country went ahead. So race has never been, that issue has never been fixed.
Well, how can you fix it in some ways? Because if the states outside of the old Confederate states want the South to have a full moral accounting for slavery, that's going to require them to accept that their great-great-great-grandpappy was a bad man. Their ancestors were bad people. They did a wicked thing to enslave other human beings.
Yeah, I think that's correct.
Yeah.
But there I think there's a way of doing it that, to say simply, look, if I kept you in my garage for 3 months and had you working night and day, and then one day I open the garage and say, oh, I'm sorry, that was a mistake. Okay, what do I need to do? What I need to do is say, that was terrible, I'm very sorry, and I would need to compensate you for your labor. I mean, that now, in the States, if you say reparations, people go nuts. But in any decent system, that's what's called for, especially a system like ours, which is so materialist and so much values work and money and reward. It's an amazing thing. And to say that trillions of dollars of labor that was stolen wouldn't somehow carry forward into the present day is just kind of silly. But I think, my thought is, and this is where Lincoln was a great genius, the first thing you do is state the truth. If you state the truth, well, you're already a lot closer to righteousness than if you are in that mode of energetic denial. So I think that's the first thing that had to, we should say the truth.
What is the feeling that you noticed while you were on the campaign trail that Donald Trump's been able to awaken in his supporters?
Well, the biggest thing I noticed was it's now become a commonplace, but this, how divided the country is in terms of where it gets its news from. It seemed often that we were just robots walking around who had been pre-programmed with certain political views. So I'm a liberal, somewhat left of Gandhi, and I'm walking around and I'm hearing this, a discourse that was largely unfamiliar to me, remarkably consistent among the people I was talking to. And when you poked at the rhetoric, there really wasn't much behind it. This was not a rhetoric that they had reasoned their way toward, but it was a rhetoric they had received from Fox and outlets.
Breitbart.
Yeah, so that was kind of nightmarish. It was Orwellian to see that people with whom I had a lot in common, we could joke and talk about sports and blah, blah. When you got into politics, there was this evidence of and I call it programming, not pejoratively, because I also was in the same boat, but two different discourses. In the piece, I say it's kind of like if the two of us rode up to a castle. We both agree it's a castle, but you'd only watched Game of Thrones and I'd only watched Monty Python. So that was really remarkable to spend all that time among people, and there was very little intersection of rhetoric. It was terrifying, actually. And then because of that frustration led to a lot of violence on both sides. And it was a nightmarish thing. I'd never really seen our country that way. I'd never imagined it as a place where quite so inhospitable or so prone to violence.
You said you detected a kind of resentment at mm-hmm. the heart of this amongst many of Trump's followers. Mm-hmm. Have you ever felt that similar kind of feeling?
Yes,
that similar resentment?
That's why I think, that piece was rejected twice because I had trouble with the analysis part. And that's why when I was young, I was from a working class neighborhood, barely got into college through the intervention of some high school teachers, went out to the Colorado School of Mines, which is an engineering school, and was so outgunned by my peers that I got into that mode where you're looking for some way to justify yourself. Why is it that I'm always at the bottom of the class? Why am I working so hard and still failing? Why have these students all been to Europe and I never have been? You know, these kind of things. So instead of saying, well, it's because I'm working class, that's all right, I bought into the Ayn Rand philosophy, you know, which basically the way I understood it was a way of setting oneself apart morally in every situation. You know?
It could confer some dignity on you, could it?
That's yes. Right, exactly right. And also, in the years that followed, our family had some financial reversals, and when I was a young married guy, we had no money. So I knew maybe better than many writers I meet what it's like to be under the heel of American capitalism. You know, Terry Eagleton said, capitalism plunders the sensuality of the body. So I had the experience of being, say, a young father with no money in the bank, barely holding on to a low-level corporate job, and looking around and seeing, actually, I'm doing okay. I have the low-level corporate job. And also, you know, the flight of money up in American culture, that 1% that Bernie Sanders talks about, it's striking. And I go to places where I spent some time as a young guy. Those towns are just decimated by this kind of corporatist, materialist aristocracy, actually. You know, you look in these towns in Texas, and along the highway, there's a very healthy set of corporate chain stores that are sending the money to other places. And in the old city center, it's all boarded up. So, you know, not to mention the opioid epidemic. So that middle and lower middle class angst is real. Now, what we might notice is the Trump movement takes in all the white people in that category, but the people of color who are similarly disadvantaged by the economic situation don't respond. So there, but yeah, this is what makes it so complicated. Is if the Trump movement had not very cynically identified these issues and used them, it would be a simpler story. But a lot of the people, some of the people that love him have been in a lot of hardship. Some of them haven't. This was maybe the other revelation of that piece, was that there were a lot of rich people.
Yeah. That's what I heard too from John Nichols, who was on the campaign trail.
It's not the Steinbeck.
His view was that they were at the Trump rally, there were a lot of people who were quite well-to-do, but felt that they were about to be knocked off by the next wave of automation.
Yes.
Their driverless cars were going to take them from their limo jobs or their chauffeur jobs, whatever kind of work they were about. They were next cab off the rank.
Yeah.
I spoke to Thomas Frank not so long ago, who is the author of that book, What's the Matter with Kansas? And his criticism is of the Democrats, and his view is that there's two hierarchies in America. One is a hierarchy of money. The other hierarchy is the hierarchy of ability, of talented people. And Obama and Bill Clinton are both perfect exemplars of that. They came from very low-income families, problematic family situations, rose to the very top of the United States and befriended other very, very clever people. But the underlying message behind that is that if you're not that clever, well, too bad. You know, just fend for yourself with whatever you get.
I would challenge that a little bit because I think I would complicate it. There's another force, which is the Republican Party. And in times when a Clinton or an Obama is trying to work to benefit the people who aren't that clever they've been stopped at every turn by Republicans, because one of the Republican ideologies that I remember loving as a young guy was it's all about merit. You know, all you have to do is work hard and the world will reward you. So there's been a steady drumbeat from the Republican Party to squash any kind of populist or middle-class benefiting moves. It's all been about the rich, you know, so it's complicated. And, it's complicated, and in a way it's tiresome at this point, because I feel like we can try to figure out what happened then, but here we are. And for me, I'm not really a complex moral thinker. I'm a fiction writer, but I keep thinking, let's just keep in mind, how should a human being behave towards his brothers and sisters? Are we doing it or not? And so instead of saying this good idea is Democratic, this good idea is Republican, you can wash all that out and say, how should we be behaving with respect to race, class, with respect to immigration, and almost make those decisions, as I think Lincoln did, from a spiritual perspective.
Yeah, this brings us back to Lincoln and his words of his first inaugural, where he said, speaking to people in the South, the slave states, "We are friends, not enemies. We must not be enemies."
Right.
He said that quite specifically and said that they should all appeal to the better angels of their nature, which is a lovely phrase.
And which didn't work.
And it didn't work.
This is the other thing.
It's like Obama
writing.
Said, there's no red America or blue America, black or white America. There's just the United States of America. That didn't work either, did it?
Yeah, it's aspirational, but
Just finally, George, last night you opened the Sydney Writers' Festival with an extraordinary speech where you told a story of a very, very unpleasant plane flight that you want to experience. Could you just please reprise that story, please?
I was flying out of Chicago many years ago and just reading a magazine, ready to get home, and there was a sound like a truck had just hit the side of the plane and it dropped, suddenly, and people start screaming and black smoke started coming out of the little air vents.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And there was an electronic sizzle that ran from the front of the plane to the back, like this. And I remember looking at that magazine thinking, okay, if I don't close the magazine, this isn't happening, And I just, the reason I told the story, and it stayed with me all these years, is that I had always imagined I'd be the kind of person who, at the moment of death would say, let me stand up and lead the airplane in a song of gratitude and go sweetly to heaven. But I couldn't even remember my own name. It was just in my mind was just this denial. No, not yet, not yet, not now.
What were you looking at while this was going on? Do you remember what you were fixing?
I just kept thinking. I had it sounds like a thought, but it was a feeling. I have to get out of this body now. And my eye fell on the seat in front of me, and I thought, and that's what's going to get me out of the body. That somehow that seat is going to get me out of this.
Impact of the seat in front of you?
Because
it's going to crush you.
Yeah. I mean, if the plane goes down, something ends you.
And how about the people around next to you?
They were completely not there for a while, and then it went on for what felt like a long time. And I heard this voice from a kid next to me who I'd forgotten, a 14-year-old kid sitting right inches away, and he just said, "Sir, is this supposed to be happening?" And that kind of woke me up. Suddenly I was able to get out of my head a little bit and kind of assured him that yes, everything was fine, and then became aware of a woman across the aisle who was crying. And so to be honest, I haven't fully unpacked that thing, but there was something very striking about how it one second I was so deeply inside my own identity and struggling with the idea that this guy, George, who I loved so well all these years, was about to stop being, that was a totally intolerable place to be. It was, sometimes I think of it and I get a little sick, but the sound of that kid's voice suddenly, and just the physical action of turning to him and trying to calm him down, suddenly I was more alive and I remembered who I was actually. So
is that a kind of grace?
I think so, and it was simply from as a Buddhist, it was the idea that in reaching out to him, I was reminded that this guy George wasn't that big of a deal. After all, he's not central, he's not permanent. Something about the action of just trying to comfort somebody was really beautiful and wonderful.
And needless to say, you didn't die.
I think, unless this has all been a great dream.
Well, I hope not, because that means I'm just some actor in it. That'd be terrible news for me. It'd make me like Tweedledum and Tweedledee in the Dream of the Red King, and I don't want to be that person, quite frankly. How did you feel after the plane landed?
Oh, I passed a flight attendant, and I said, that probably happens all the time. And she was pale, and she said, not in 30 years, sir. But some geese had flown into the engine and basically shut it down.
All it was.
And it's not that. Right. I think it's somewhat uncommon, but we still had one engine to get back on. But what was really lovely, and this is the other part of it, was for 3 or 4 days after that, the world was unspeakably beautiful. Everything was a cheeseburger was a kind of a miracle. And then about day three, I started to just be me again, and you get your old habits back, and you feel that once again that death will never come for you.
Oh no! How do you get back to that place?
Yeah, well, it was a little bit unbearable, but I think the way you get back to that is probably years and years of spiritual practice.
But then life calls to you, and you've got to get on. You can't sit there and meditate all the time.
No. Well, the other thing that happened was a few years ago, I had another plane thing, and exactly the same feelings came back, and I thought, I haven't progressed at all.
Just one more thing. I know I keep holding you, but there's this lovely, incredible moment, and it's the most moving part of your novel for me, where the spirit of Willie Lincoln is so distressed by his father's grief, he enters his father's body, and there's this lovely moment where you talk about Willie feeling his father's long legs, what it's like to have a beard, and the taste of coffee in his mouth. And I think that's so lovely. And it seems like you inhabited Lincoln in that moment too. That's an audacious thing to do.
That move is kind of what fiction writers try to do. You know, can I be you for 20 seconds? And it's so profound. You know, if one could be somebody else for 20 seconds, I think the rest of the world would look different forever.
Amen to that, brother.
Amen.
What a pleasure to speak with you, George. I hope I get to speak with you again next time we can, if you survive the next plane ride to Australia. That's when goes all right for you. I really appreciate you talking with me today, George.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
George Saunders' novel is called Lincoln in the Bardo. abc.net.au/conversations. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.